Okay, thank you. This oral argument is being held on the Zoom platform. The same procedural rules apply to these, our Zoom oral arguments, as apply to our in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The marshal is keeping time in the grid view. Hopefully you're able to see that. If not, let us know. And we ask that you please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you very much. Good morning to the court and to counsel. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kevin Beach. I represent the appellant Farm Bureau Financial Services in this matter. Today, my client is requesting that the court reverse and remand the district court's order to dismiss this case with prejudice based on an alleged lack of justiciability, and reverse and remand the confirmation of the underlying arbitration award for respondent IRA. Apologies in advance for any mispronunciations of names, as my involvement in this case since Thursday of this last week has been solely through review of the written materials. Previous counsel in this case, Mr. Peters, left practice and moved to California, and Mr. Stemple was unavailable. This is a case of much more factual complexity and nuance than may be readily apparent from the record before you. As the case developed and more information was gathered, appellant noticed possible irregularities in the facts surrounding how the accident occurred, the composition of individuals in the vehicle, and possible involvement of what is known as a clinic runner. Appellants sought to duly investigate the suspect actions, but were unable to do so for various circumstances. And in the few instances where information was obtained, that information only begat more questions, necessitating further review and investigation. However, before review could be effectuated, this case was dismissed with prejudice, not based on emotion, but based on the alleged lack of justiciability that the court found. And in a moment of seeming judicial dissonance, even though there was found to be a lack of justiciability, the arbitration award to the incarcerated individual respondent IRA was confirmed. This is a significantly more, for lack of a better word, exciting case than the stereotypical car incident, car crash. It started for our involvement in this case on April 2nd, 2018,
Mr. Beach?
Snowy day. Yes, of course.
Can I take you from the facts into a?
Of course.
I'm trying to figure out. I'm sorry you're new to this case, but maybe you've gotten your mind around something I can't quite get my mind around, which is the district court's analysis. I'm wondering whether you agree with this possibility that the district court's analysis about whether or not a complaint in this case was sufficient as a substitute for a motion, whether that's sort of the front domino that leads to the justiciability issue, because that become, if you treat it as a deck action instead of treat it as you would if it were a motion, would that cause a different result? Help me to understand your view of just the overall structure of the district court's decision.
Of course. I believe that there is at times a significant focus on one of the defendants, that being a defendant IRA. I do believe that it is a domino in there, but it is not pivotal and absolutely necessary domino. As we would say within the facts of the complaint based on the rules of civil procedure 702, we believe that it is a motion because it is in writing. It states the grounds for the reason that we're asking, and then there is the relief that's being requested. But we believe that the declaratory action itself is still necessary because it applies to all of the defendants in this case. There was a video actually of the accident, which I have not been able to review, but counsel has been able to review, and I believe opposing counsel has reviewed at one point. There were questions about how the accident actually occurred and whether or not there was misrepresentations of fact in ways that the accident occurred, as well as when there was.
I want to get back into the law.
Of course.
So the ID case is a case the district court distinguished Your client was arguing that this was a basis for the district court to treat this as a motion. Give me your understanding of what exactly the ID case held and why it would apply to this case.
Yeah, of course. I would say that this is actually distinguishable from the ID case. And one of the reasons being is related to what I said previously, that a lack of development in the record. Based on the submissions I've been able to review, but unfortunately are not before the court right now, as it is not part of the record, but I can tell you as an officer of the court, there was a 5G submission in the case of the respondent Dot A. Ray, where my counsel Stemple opposed the arbitration based on a breach of contract, as well as during the arbitration
I want to go back to the ID case.
Of course.
The district court distinguished ID and said this, it doesn't apply here. And that's how your client lost. You're agreeing that that ID should is distinguished? I just want to understand your position.
Yes, of course. Let me just review this one aspect to make sure that I'm consistent with that. So within the ID case, it was based on my understanding of the case, ID was saying that there is an exception to a formal motion and saying that in order for the formal motion, if there is not the formal motion, that there has to be an objection on the record to the arbitration, and there has to be a
what's your argument, counsel? Is your argument that the declaratory judgment complaint is a motion? Is that your argument?
Yes, that is
okay,
part of the
argument. So you just mentioned Rule 702, and I just pulled up 702. And 702 talks about what a motion is, and it says that motions provided in these rules are motions requiring a written notice to the party and a hearing before the order can be issued. Did you do that?
There was a written, as far, there was not a written notice thereof, but there was order from the court for written submissions and for oral argument on this matter. In the complaint itself, we requested, at a certain point, I think we're looking at perhaps substance over form.
But we're talking about a matter of statutory interpretation. 572B.23 provides that upon a motion by a party to the arbitration proceeding, the court shall vacate an award. So I don't understand why traditional principles of statutory construction would not apply. I mean, it seems to be an unambiguous statute requiring a motion. A motion is defined by 702, and there are requirements for a motion, for something to constitute a motion. So I'm not quite sure why the thing that you did in the district court qualifies as a motion within the meaning of the rules and the statute.
And I think when that was pointed out to counsel who was previously handling this case, they said if they would like the formal process of notice so that there can be a formal hearing on the matter, we would be happy to do so. But before that could even be effectuated, this matter was dismissed on a basis of lack of justiciability. And there was—
Mr. Beach, would you agree that in the typical case, the filing of a complaint is not treated as a motion? The filing of the complaint is a different legal document than a motion?
In a lot of instances—
Or pleading, rather?
Say,
I'm sorry,
yes.
Go ahead.
No, that's quite right. I would say in a lot of instances, that may be the case. One of the issues that surrounds these no-fault arbitration cases is the arbitrators have a very specific purview, which they have, which is to look at the information before there, see if the facts support that there was an accident of some kind or that the treatment was reasonable and necessary. And the only way, the hard part about those cases is you have to figure out when you're going to bring a declaratory motion. You can't bring it in the beginning because in several different cases, they'll say, well, you have to go to the arbitrator first.
Mr. Beach,
you filed your complaint. I'm sorry.
No, I'm getting a little frustrated here. So the ID case considered whether the insurer's failure to file a motion to vacate the arbitration award precluded the court from exercising de novo review. That was the issue in ID. That's the issue here. The district court that your client, your predecessor argued that this case fits under ID. The district court distinguished ID. And it seems to me that whether this is a motion or something else, maybe it's not a motion, but ID stood for the proposition that you don't have to have a motion. But I'm trying to get a sense of whether the district court was right in distinguishing this case from ID. And you're not discussing ID. So that's, I'm a little frustrated because I'm not sure you win if the district court's right.
Apologies. I would say that the district court may have been mistaken in this case. One of the mistakes in that is when they were analyzing ID, they said that there was no objection to the arbitration before that this occurred. And I think there was a lot of weight that was given to that by the court, as well as by the respondents in that matter. And there was an objection, but we weren't able to add things to the record to show
what,
that.
What do you understand the holding of ID to be generally and specifically? And in answering that, can you tell me whether there's any rationale that underlies the ID decision that we ought to apply to this case in your client's favor or not?
I would say that within the ID decision, the idea is that there are instances where a formal motion is not necessary. But one of the instances when that's not necessary, there has to be an objection, and there has to be, in the ID decision, there was specifically that they were ordered to arbitration, which in this case is slightly different, but there is effectively a statutory way by which we're forced into arbitration, which is through 65B, whereby amounts in controversy less than $10,000 have to go to arbitration. So that is the distinction.
What do you make of the fact that ID relies on the predecessor version of the statute from 1990, and that the arbitration statute was amended in 2010? Now we're dealing with 572B.23 as opposed to the predecessor 572.19. Is there some meaningful distinction in the language between those two statutes that might explain why the district court did what it did?
I haven't been able to, apologies, Your Honor, I haven't been able to actually review that specific distinction. I was having a lot of more focus on some other areas, especially as it relates to the other aspects of the justiciability, as well as
your predecessor had argued that had pointed out that a different federal district court or state district court judge in the fourth district, Judge Burke, had in fact considered this issue and applied ID in the way that you're asking, you were asking us to apply ID, but I'm getting the sense now that you've backed away from that.
I apologies if that appears to be the case. I would say that I'm still sticking to that instance. One of the things I was just trying to draw attention to was a lack of development in the record as far as some aspects that the court, some factual circumstances that the court had relied upon, such as the lack of an objection. And I think that in conjunction with the arguments that were previously made related to ID would sway significantly more towards the appellant's interpretation of the way that ID applies to this case.
The district court described this as a case of ripeness. It looks like it's more about mootness or perhaps about forfeiture. I didn't see an argument in your brief outlining any distinction that we ought to be making in that regard as to justiciability.
That is correct. It doesn't seem that it was included in there, and I did not get a chance to work through a reply.
I'm sorry, I cut Judge Cochran off. I think she had a question.
That's all right.
I just wanted to clarify that you would agree that there wasn't a formal objection to arbitration in this case.
I would say that there was an objection to arbitration within the Rule 5G submissions from Counsel Stemple in this matter, but that was not part of the record.
So you agree you say it's not part of the record, and there wasn't an objection in district court?
I do not have specific knowledge as to that in a written form. No, the complaint itself could be seen as an objection to.
But that's after the arbitration happened. That's where I'm having trouble viewing the complaint as a motion, because in IDE, the action was, there was an action to compel arbitration, and the objection was stated in court in response to that motion. Here, the arbitration went forward, and then afterwards, there's a complaint for declaratory judgment filed, not a motion, and it wasn't termed as a motion to vacate. And so help me understand how a complaint in that circumstance can be viewed as a motion to vacate where the normal motion practice wasn't followed. It was treated as a complaint, and discovery proceeded as it would after in the normal course of litigation.
I think there was a heavy reliance on the decision before Judge Susan Burke in the Fourth Judicial District Court, where a similar circumstance occurred, as well as the fact that there were multiple respondents in this scenario. And the complaint is trying to address many things at once, more than just the vacation of the arbitration award, but a possibility of the clinic runners, which would be a violation of Minnesota Statute 65B, which would invalidate all of these payments, as well as there's a possibility of misrepresentations of fact of the initial incident itself. So I think it was trying to address a lot of things at once, prospectively in the interest of judicial economy, but at a certain point it may lack some of the specificity that would have been better by individual motions.
All right, thank you for your responses to our questions. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, your honors, counsel. My name is Brad Rapkin, and I am the attorney representing the respondents in this matter. In fairness, and just as a matter of candor, I was not the handling attorney of the underlying no-fault arbitrations. That was left to my associate attorney, Felix Valenzasca. However, the way we have our law firm set up, he handles those things, and when it gets to be bigger and more complex, then I take over just based on years of experience. In any event, our argument to the court is that this complaint was neither a valid declaratory judgment action, nor was it or should it be considered a valid attempt to vacate the underlying arbitration award of respondent Da'e Ray.
Let me pause you for a minute there. The complaint expressly asks for a vacation of the award, doesn't it? As a remedy?
It does.
Okay.
It does as a remedy.
And based on the allegation that the arbitrator exceeded powers by imposing this condition on the insurer's opportunity to ask questions on the record under oath.
Correct. That's their theory. But there's statute in this. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a specific. So let's talk about IDE, because I'm the district court focused on it. Your brief mentions it. It was argued in front of the district court. Judge Burke decided an issue just like this. It didn't come up on appeal, but there's at least one judge who thinks that ID would apply in this circumstance. Tell me why ID doesn't. And you know, of course, in ID, the issue at least generally was the same, which is, even though the statute's different, the question was whether the failure to, I'm quoting from ID, the failure to formally file a motion, when you've got this statute that appears to require the formally filing of a motion, precludes the district court from addressing the legal issue, challenging the whether the award should be vacated. Or looking, in that case, it was a de novo, whether the district court should take a de novo review of the arbitration decision. So explain to me why you think ID doesn't apply. First, tell me what you think ID is holding and whether the district court got the distinction correctly.
Sure. The district court in the other case that comes up in the briefs by Judge Burke in the 4th Judicial District, I was also the attorney handling that case. So this is not our first rodeo with Mr. Stemple's office and his attempt at what we believe is an end around on the motion to vacate rules and procedures. And we believe that to be the case because the standard is extremely high to overturn a no-fault arbitration award. But ID, to answer your question, Judge Ross, ID is the exception. It is not the rule, okay?
Right, and that's my question is, why isn't this case fit within that exception? And would you agree with me that ID at least stands for the proposition, generally speaking, that a formal motion is not required under some circumstances?
Only in limited circumstances would I agree with that proposition. And those limited circumstances do not exist in this case.
Okay, tell me more about that.
So in ID, that's a little bit more of a complex arbitration. It's not your standard mandatory no-fault arbitration. So there's a little bit of a difference in context, number one. Number two, in the complicated proceedings running up to the arbitration in ID, the appealing party objected to having to participate in the arbitration proceeding, and the court ordered it. Here, the arbitration proceeding isn't court ordered, and the appellant never objected to the arbitration proceedings going forward.
Okay, this is my problem. That is exactly the rationale of the district court in this case. And I wonder whether that was a fair distinction. In ID, the issue was whether the case should go to arbitration at all because the insurer was saying, this case settles. We have a valid settlement agreement for $15,000. There's no reason to go to arbitration. We shouldn't do it. And so the legal issue there, I mean, keeping in mind 572B23, which is whether the arbitrator exceeded its powers. In that case, the powers that were allegedly being exceeded was even looking at the case at all, because there shouldn't be an arbitration according to the insurer. It had already been settled. So in that case, it makes perfect sense to me that if the insurer doesn't object to the arbitration, that is a factor. In our case, the legal issue isn't whether the arbitration should have occurred. The legal issue happened during the arbitration, which is the arbitrator's decision to provide, to create this qualification, the condition on whether Farmers Bureau gets to go and take the deposition, I'll call it. So tell me, you're shaking your head no, so go ahead. It's a confusing circumstance. Tell me how I'm wrong.
I mean, no disrespect, but I
think that's okay. You don't have to be respectful. Just tell me where I'm wrong.
I think you're misunderstanding the timing of when the arbitrator acted, when the arbitrator preconditioned the payment of benefits upon the granting of the examination under oath. That happened pre-hearing. Okay. So in these underlying no-fault arbitration proceedings, you have you have the pre-filing part of the process where the appellant requests an examination under oath. The respondent denies it, saying, we don't believe that you've proven that it's reasonably necessary per the Thompson case. Then the next step, Your Honor, is when the arbitration petition is filed and an arbitrator is appointed, then both parties get to brief the issue to the arbitrator in a pre-hearing setting, and then the arbitrator then decides. On two of the three cases, the arbitrator selected for those arbitration hearings denied appellant's request for an examination under oath, agreeing with respondent that the requested examination under oath had not been proven to be reasonably necessary. In the Da'e Ray case, the arbitrator found that there were circumstances making it reasonably necessary, but he said, look, you're going to have to pay benefits up until the time that you requested the examination under oath. Sitting right. on your hands right, right, right. is no basis for delay in payments. The No Fault Act is specific and says you have 30 days to pay or deny. They didn't right. either. So the but arbitrator was enforcing that part of the statute.
I get that, but that's the
that
argument.
That happened during the hearing. That was before the hearing.
Okay.
And the insurer and the
let's say hold Bureau, on a second. Okay. Let's say it was before the hearing. Are you saying that if a motion had been made under 572B23 after the arbitration decision, that Farm Bureau would not be allowed to raise the argument that the arbitrator's condition exceeded the arbitrator's powers? That's something that the district court would not consider in the motion because of the timing of it.
No, I'm not saying that at all. Had they followed the proper procedure and followed the motion to vacate an arbitration award, then the court could have considered it. We would have objected to it because Farm Bureau did not object to the arbitration proceeding as required by the no-fault rules.
Right, but just so I understand you correctly, and this gets me back around to my point or to the part where I'm having struggle with the case. It sounds like you're conceding the fact that if this had been a motion, rather than a civil complaint, a motion within 90 days after the arbitration decision, that in that case, the district court could consider it. You would have a substantive argument why the argument would fail or why the issue would fail, but the district court could still consider it.
Sure, the district court could consider it. We believe that argument would rest with the respondent.
No, I get that. And this is where I go back to ID. If we do treat this as the case, as ID did, as sufficient, that how it got to the district court doesn't matter, that what's really being challenged is the arbitrator's exercise of powers, then you can argue substantively on the question. But sure. District court in this case said, you know, you don't even get it considered. It's just a justiciability issue. You're done.
Right. That happened in the case with Judge Burke. We went up and we were complaining and making the same argument saying, look, this is the improper way of doing things. They should not be allowed to use a declaratory judgment action as an end around to a motion to vacate. A motion to vacate is limited in scope. A declaratory judgment action, we believe, is an attempt for the appellant to get greater discovery rights, to attempt to relitigate issues that have already been considered. And the granting of an EUO or not.
Now we turn to a beat exclusive.
A question of fact that is entirely and squarely within the purview of the arbitrator per the cases.
Well, that's the problem I've got. The arbitrator said in this case, as a matter of fact, the request was reasonable and the denial was not reasonable. So that fact issue is done. The question now is whether the legal question of whether the arbitrator then can impose this cost condition. I think that's a legal issue. I'm not saying you lose on that issue, but it seems to me that whether it's a question of fact or not, that's not what's being challenged.
Sure. It's kind of like if this were, instead of a no-fault arbitration, let's say this was a trial in district court, okay, and the judge makes a ruling, you have to have an objection to preserve the issue for appeal, right? They didn't object. They didn't preserve the issue for appeal. They lose.
Mr. Ratkin, I'd like to take you back to a question that Judge Frisch asked Mr. Breach, which is, when ID was decided, there was a different statutory framework. It was 572.19 that was at issue, I believe, in that case, and now we have 572B. But I'm looking at 572.19, and subdivision 1 says, upon application of a party, the court shall vacate an award where, and then it lists the various circumstances. And Judge Frisch is, I think, looking at the same statute, whereas the current statute, 572B.23, specifies that it upon filing or upon motion of a party to the arbitration proceeding, the court shall vacate an award if various conditions are met. So in your view, is that difference in statutory language important in our analysis here, the difference between upon application of a party and upon motion versus upon motion of a party?
Yes, it seems that in 2010, a difference was recognized and developed by the legislature. And it made it so that a motion to vacate an arbitration award was now specifically required unless you had extraordinary circumstances that created an exception like the ID case.
Okay, so how do you square that answer with the language in ID? I understand what the statute said in ID. It doesn't say motion, but the ID decision read it that way, read the old statute that way and analyzed it that way, didn't it? Whether the insurer's failure to, quote, formally file a motion to vacate the arbitration award precluded the trial court from exercising the review. It seems like whether it was in the statute or not expressly, that's exactly how this court analyzed it. Am I wrong?
Which court are you referring to, the ID court or the Abrams court?
The ID court, not the okay. Abrams court. The ID court, that's the language the ID court used. It framed it as if it was a question of whether there was a formal motion, as if the rule required, the statute required it. And am I misreading the ID analysis?
No, I don't think you're misreading it. I don't think it applies in this case where you have a mandatory no-fault arbitration, and then you have a specific statute with specific requirements and time limitations with which to file a motion, okay? ID was not a no-fault arbitration. You know, the case is factually distinguishable. That's what we argued to Judge Abrams. Judge Abrams agreed with us. Whether or not you agree with him or not is up to the court. But we believe that our argument presented to Judge Abrams and then his further expounding on that is the proper analysis for ID as not the rule, but the exception to the rule only in extremely limited circumstances. And this case is not that.
Isn't ID really a form over substance decision? Like it's saying we're not going to elevate form over substance.
No, I think it's a recognition by the court that sometimes it is not possible to get the right form. And then we're not going to elevate form over substance, but where it is possible, and it was possible in this case that we're arguing before the court today, then the ID exception doesn't apply. And the statute regarding appealing no-fault arbitration awards, which is specific, applies wholeheartedly.
So as a practical matter, for a practitioner who wants to vacate an arbitration award, they would have to file some initiating document, a pleading of some kind. But concurrent with that, they'd also be required to file a motion, similar to a request for injunctive relief. You need a complaint and a motion for injunctive relief in order to get that. The same would apply, in your view, for a practitioner in a request to vacate an arbitration proceeding, or do they just have to file a motion?
They just have to file the motion to vacate.
And that initiates the action in district court?
It does, because the district court is essentially sitting as your court, as the first level of appeal on a no-fault arbitration award. So that is enough.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question, Judge Cochran? I know that we're
certainly over time.
So, Mr. Rackin, let's take you to a fifth grade class, and you're the lawyer, and a student raises his hand. You're explaining the process, and a student says, I don't understand. What is this motion? What does that mean? What exactly is a motion? What sort of synonym would you offer a student to understand what exactly a motion is?
Well, I would tell the student that it is a specific paper and procedure to move a court to act.
Well, it's not always. I mean, our courts have said a motion can be oral. It doesn't have to be on paper. I mean, isn't a motion really just a request? We're asking the court to do something. And we call it a motion because we've got some procedures around it. But we also... in this case, the procedure to file a motion has got to be within 90 days. In this case, the deck action came within 90 days. There has to be a challenge to the arbitrator's powers. In this case, there's an allegation in the complaint to the arbitrator's powers. And there has to be a request for a vacation. And in this case, that was the remedy sought. So if I'm a fifth grader and you're saying, okay, yeah, but this is different. what would you tell the fifth grader? And you can feel free to assume that I have the brain of a fifth grader even you answer this question.
I guess at that point, I would explain to the fifth grader that the law, when it's specific, has to be followed. And where there is no room for exception, then you cannot argue the exception, and you have to follow the specific statute or case law. And we have both in this case. We have a specific statute that says to vacate a no-fault arbitration award. It has to be by way of a motion within 90 days, and then you have to meet the burden of proof. And then we have case law in the Bankston case that says a declaratory judgment action is not a substitute for a motion to vacate an arbitration award.
I have a follow-up to Judge Ross's question, assuming again that you're talking to a fifth grader, or I'm a fifth grader. How would you distinguish a complaint from a motion?
Oh, you're taking me back to civil procedure class, Your Honor.
good memories, I'm sure.
Sure.
You know, I think good thing it's hot out because I'm sweating now. In terms of a complaint, you know, a complaint, you have to establish, jurisdiction, right? You have to establish facts supporting, you know, the alleged wrong. And then you have to have a prayer for relief. Whereas a motion, you know, especially a motion to vacate a mandatory no-fault arbitration award, that's like an appeal. So I feel like the question isn't exactly fair in the no-fault arena because the motion to vacate is really an appeal and not necessarily a standard motion, if you will.
So you're saying that this question is above a fifth grade level?
I
respect your answer. It's a complicated question, and there isn't probably an answer that you can boil down to that level. So,
right. And the complicated part of this case, okay, it's complicated facts, but it's made further complicated by what the law firm for the appellant both did and didn't do. Okay, they didn't object to the arbitration ruling. They didn't ask for a stay of the arbitration proceeding so that they could pursue a timely declaratory judgment action in district court. And then they gambled on the arbitration award. They lost. And then instead of appealing an arbitration award like they ought to through the statutory procedure of a motion to vacate, they attempted an end around, trying to give themselves greater rights. If you allow this to happen, this is going to continue to happen with Mr. Stemple's office and with other law firms.
Well, what if we narrowed it down? What if we said you can't get anything more from your, whether you call it a deck action or whatever, than you could from a motion? We're going to limit you. You can't get any broader relief than you could get in a motion. What if we did that in that case? Wouldn't that satisfy your concern?
Well, it's a declaratory judgment action. What is there to declare? Okay, it's improper form. Okay, and
well,
if I were to file a complaint one day after the statute ran, and I said, "What? But my client was injured. They deserve compensation." The court would say, "No, no, you violated the practice and procedure. You know, you violated the way we as lawyers, you know, do things."
Well, no, that's a deadline.
It has to be specifically followed.
That's a deadline. In this case, the deck action was filed within the 90 days. Anyway,
it wasn't a deck action, Your Honor.
Mr. Ratkin.
It absolutely is not a deck action.
In your view, would the proper procedure have been to file a motion to vacate as to the first named respondent? Because the complaint seems to focus on the arbitration award with regard to that respondent and file a separate action or actions relating to the other respondents.
Yeah, that's one of our points.
Whether it be a deck action or a motion to vacate, depending on whether an arbitration had happened.
Right. And so when they're bringing the deck action and trying to marry it to an attempted motion to vacate, it gets really confusing because, you know, they're saying the deck action applies to the three cases in arbitration, you know, and potentially to the two that are not. But the motion to vacate only applies to one, although they name all five respondents, you know, as parties to the litigation. So, you know, what they ought to have done, Your Honor, from a timing perspective, if they had problems with how the arbitrators decided the EEO issue, they should have objected in writing to any further proceedings and then remove the matter to district court and then filed their complaint for declaratory relief, at which time the court had a controversy that they could decide, that they could declare whether rights, you know, or duties were violated. And then with regard to any of the arbitration awards that they felt were not proper or where there had been arbitrator misconduct, then they should have on those individual cases filed motions to vacate. They could have even said in their caption that it was a combined complaint for declaratory relief and motion to vacate. They didn't.
Judge Cochran, can I impose just one more question? I promise. Just one more. Would you agree, Mr. Rackin, I assume, that if we were to disagree with you about ID and say that it does apply to this case, that it would only apply, we'd have to limit it to the one arbitration, and none of the other defendants?
Correct. If you said, no, we think ID applies, the only case they're moving to vacate the arbitration award is on the DA Ray case.
Well, I'm glad we're not in fifth grade, but I feel like I am.
I don't know if that's a compliment or
No, it's not on you. I'll just say I found it confusing. I found the district court's approach confusing. So because it creates this justiciability question, and it seems like you're arguing more for forfeiture, which seems to me to be what really is going on, instead of a ripeness or mootness question. So anyway, I think it's because of the setting, and it's just getting my mind around it. That's all. It's not your fault. You're doing as good as you can with a tough issue, I think.
If I can draw the court's attention, there was defendant's memorandum of law addressing this issue, and we went beyond just justiciability. Judge Abrams was saying, hey, I want you to look at ripeness.
Right.
And so I briefed it thoroughly there. I just had to narrow it down for the court for purposes of oral argument here. And so I narrowed it down to what the judge decided the case on in his memorandum, but it was fully briefed by the respondents in that memorandum of law to the district court. If you want to take a look back at that, we do address all of those other issues. I mean, I learned a lot.
So, Mr. Rackin, I think that is helpful information, and we certainly have the record, full record before us. We appreciate all your helpful answers, and we've allowed you some additional time. And so now we'll turn to Mr. Beach.
Thank you.
Thank you. One of the things that I think it sometimes may be missed, even in the district court's decision, and at times maybe even in complaint, is that this is trying to address, the declaratory action is trying to address a lot at once.
Let me ask you, was that the appropriate approach? It seems to me that what should have happened here, or one alternative approach, is that you could have filed a motion to vacate on behalf of Da'e Ray and filed separate actions or motions, depending on whether there had been an arbitration with regard to the other four respondents. Why is this approach that you took appropriate as opposed to that alternative approach, or the approach suggested by Mr. Rackin?
Yeah, of course. I think, because I wasn't the one obviously making those decisions at that time, I think it went a lot to what Judge Ross was saying about they were looking significantly more at function than form in some of these instances. They were trying to, it may have been better to stay the matter, stay all three arbitrations, or if not the stay, then file for the individual motions, then file the declaratory action. But at this point, this is what we end up with. And I do really believe that the ED case applies in this scenario, even though that was evaluated an application at that time versus a motion itself.
Well, let's assume it does. Let's assume it does apply. And we would treat this as a motion. You'd have to agree with Mr. Ratkin, wouldn't you, that if this is sort of an end around, you've got the procedure you're supposed to follow, which is a motion, and we're going to apply, assume we applied ID to say, we're going to, you know, not going to elevate form over substance. If that's the case, all you get is this challenge as to Ray and nobody else. Why would you get, if this were a motion and you're asking for a vacation under the motion, you only get Da'e Ray in the way that this has been captioned and the way that it's being, in the way it reached the, well, the way the district court decided it, right?
I believe it, as it relates to that idea of the motion, correct. One of the other aspects of this, though, is as a declaratory action, it's challenging the entire validity of the way that the insurance contract applies to them in this scenario. There's the possibility that if it was fraud, as we were trying to investigate, trying to figure out, a possibility of relating back a future challenge, as well as the fact is that Lei Sen Lei actually withdrew their request for no-fault benefits. So that is still outstanding. So there's the possibility of that coming in.
That's where it starts feeling a lot like forfeiture, where you have the decision by the arbitrator that whether you are, you aren't going to get these examinations on the record under oath, and you proceed to arbitration anyway. It seems to me, I mean, why isn't that a matter of forfeiture as to everybody, at least other than Da'e Ray?
And it may be in certain aspects as it relate to examinations under oath. One of the things that would affect all of these is the investigation and the subpoena of Hito Ro, I believe is the pronunciation, who is a prospective clinic runner. And if we were able to get more information there, it turns out they were a clinic runner, they'd be in violation of a statute prohibiting such, which would impact all of these arbitrations and prospective arbitrations. As it relates to these other aspects, we do indeed believe that ED applies in this scenario. If the record was open, we'd be able to show some of the objections. It was not open at that time. And we very much agree with the idea that substance over form is what's important in this aspect.
Well,
substance.
Go ahead, Judge Cochran. No, go ahead.
If substance is more important than form, why didn't you follow the traditional motion practice of scheduling a hearing, filing a memorandum of law and support?
There was.
If the complaint was really intended to be a motion.
I think in the beginning that they were trying to get as many different, this was spreading out at all different angles at once. And they were trying to get as many things in there as possible. When it was brought to the attention that the court thought that there should have been a proper motion, we requested leave to do so, to file a motion.
Doesn't that mean that you didn't really view it as a motion? Because you weren't proceeding like it was a motion until the court brought it to your attention. It sounds like is what you just said. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong.
Apologies. Yes. I believe we were relying heavily. It was Mr. Stubble's office that was in the Judge Burke instance, relying heavily on that, believing that their interpretation of ED and seeing this as very much analogous there too, that it was not necessarily required when it seemed like the judge was indicating that that may not be the case in this instance, that they may disagree with Judge Burke's interpretation. We were willing to amend the complaint to conform with their interpretation of the statute, but we were effectively told we could not do so. There was no motion to dismiss this matter. And there wasn't actually a motion to confirm the arbitration award. They were both just kind of granted by the court and everything was closed very quickly.
By the time you made the request for an opportunity to bring a motion, was that beyond the 90 days then?
I would have to go back through the record.
Assume it was.
I do believe it would have been beyond the 90 days, but I
So if that's the case, if in fact the deck action is not enough to be treated as a motion and you actually need a motion, there would be no reason to allow for the amendment. There wouldn't be an abuse of discretion, would there, in not allowing an amendment for an untimely motion beyond the 90-day requirement?
Possibly there could be an argument made that they were made significantly aware of the issues that were pending and there was an intent to bring something that effectuated as a motion under E that may allow for that lapse in time. But based on a strict interpretation of the way that you posited and the way that ED is put forward, I would say that would be correct.
Any further questions from the panel?
No, just thank you to both lawyers for, I mean, it was a, yeah, I don't have any questions.
Thank you. This is actually my first oral argument.
Well,
maybe you won't come back.
I'll try.
It can only get easier after a case like this, Mr. Beach.
Hopefully.
Thank you both for your helpful responses, and we will look very closely at the issues before us and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.